Welcome to Exhibiting Faith, the podcast about the intersection of art and faith. From art in sacred spaces to artists and curators engaged with issues of faith, each episode welcomes a different guest for whom faith has played a significant role in their life and work. I'm David Trigg, and today I'm speaking with Laura Moffat, the Director of Art and Christianity, an organisation which seeks to foster and explore the dialogue between art, Christianity, and other religious traditions. Since the early 1990s, the organisation has forged relationships with galleries, institutions, and places of worship, and is working to raise awareness of the rich heritage of modern and contemporary art in church buildings. Laura studied fine art at the University of Newcastle and arts criticism at City, University of London. Before becoming Director of Art and Christianity, she worked for Art Monthly and the Hoxton Gallery, Pier. She is a member of the Diocesan Advisory Committee for the Care of Churches and sits on the Church Buildings Council, which advises on the care, conservation and development of church buildings. Laura spoke to me about her work with art and Christianity and took me out on a tour of London churches to visit a selection of modern and contemporary artworks that the organisation is documenting as part of its Ecclesiart project. I began our conversation by asking Laura how art and Christianity got started.
It was the brainchild, really, of a priest called Tom Devonshire Jones, who at the time in the early 90s was vicar of St Mark's Regent's Park. Tom was, well, he had read classics before becoming ordained, but really had an incredible passion for the visual arts. So that passion bled through, really. I think he felt it was definitely a part of his vocation. So at the same time as being a full-time vicar, he began Art and Christianity as a way to sort of bring together artists, art historians, curators, with theologians and clergy so that the dialogue could sort of flourish under some sort of network or umbrella, if you like.
And when was that? When did it start?
So in 1991, he sent out the first of what was then called the Bulletin, what we now call Art and Christianity, which is a journal, comes out once every quarter. And in 1994, it was set up as a charity formally.
And what was he really hoping to achieve in setting up Art and Christianity?
I think it was really moments when the dialogue between the visual arts and the church could flourish, and be that through events such as a kind of study day at the National Gallery, when you might have, you know, art historians, curators talking with theologians about religious art, but not necessarily. I mean, some of the study days that have been held might have been about Joseph Beuys, or we've done one on Rothko. I mean, obviously there are religious inflections in their work, but they're not really religious artists as such. So either moments like that, or through the commissioning of new art. So Tom did a lot of work, and we still do that now, giving advice to churches and artists about ways in which they work together. It's obviously that the church is historically an important patron of the visual arts, but in the 20th century that has diminished considerably for all sorts of reasons, mainly financial, I think. But there are still ways, I think, of some very fruitful collaborations between artists and churches.
And Art and Christianity seeks to foster and explore the dialogue between art, Christianity and other religious faiths. Could you say a bit more about how practically that is achieved?
Yeah, so I've mentioned some of those things. The events continue. We have nearly monthly events. We produce a journal, which is a 20-page critical journal, so reviews of exhibitions and books, as well as other articles, which I feel is incredibly important, because it's very rare otherwise that, for instance, new commissions of art in churches would be reviewed properly. They might get a kind of tent-liner caption in The Guardian or something, but they wouldn't get a proper critical review, and I feel strongly that that's what we provide through the journal. And then our work with artists and churches, so either very sort of light-touch advice work, or sometimes we're more deeply involved in commissioning new works of art.
And it's a membership organisation, and I wonder what kind of people are becoming members. I suppose artists and people involved in the church who are interested in art, but what kind of people does it attract?
It's a mixture. It's definitely a mixture of, we do have artists who are members, we have clergy and academics, and then it runs really right through to people who are just interested. It's fair to say it's an older demographic, so I think people in retirement might sort of begin looking at art more in their spare time. And, if they're a person that also has a faith, then they enjoy bringing those two things together, I think.
Do you find younger people are also becoming interested?
We do, and it's really interesting at the moment, I think. We're at a time where it feels like perhaps things are slightly are changing and definitely sort of opening up a bit more. I think there's a real resurgence in a way of openly talking about spiritual things, not necessarily, Orthodox Christianity, but ways that people might live better. And I think, if art and Christianity can be a part of that way of being, then I think that's something we should be doing. We shouldn't shy away from it.
I'd like you to tell me a bit more about your story and how you came to become director of Art and Christianity. So when did you get involved in the organisation?
I started working in 2002 for Art and Christianity when they were setting up an award scheme for art, architecture and a book. And they needed an administrator for that work. So that's how I began.
But what initially attracted you to it?
I had found out about the existence of the organisation because I was opening the post at Art Monthly, where I worked at the time. And saw an invitation from them to one of the study days at the National Gallery. So I went along and was welcomed very warmly.
What was it, when you saw that invitation, when you opened that post, what was it really that piqued your interest? Because I would imagine maybe some other people wouldn't be quite so drawn to it as you were.
To be honest, I remember thinking, oh, good, something like that exists. Because I grew up in a clergy household, and my father's a vicar, and actually my brother's a vicar now as well. But I then went to art school. I studied at Newcastle, and during that time, I definitely had a period when I was trying to explore what contemporary art in a church might look like. And it was quite difficult to research something like that. This pre-internet, so it was really hard to find out whether there were contemporary artists making work for churches anymore. And so when I saw that invitation, it was literally, as I say, a moment of, oh good, somebody is doing this work, and perhaps I can be a part of that.
In the church or churches that you were brought up in, were there many images and artworks around in the churches?
Yes and no. We moved a fair bit, but the church that my father was vicar of when I was a teenager was up in Warrington, and the church had been reordered by George Pace, and his work is incredibly distinctive in that it's quite sort of almost stark, but beautiful, very beautiful. And I really enjoyed seeing that and being there Sunday by Sunday. And I think my dad did too. He would certainly say he's not really a visual person, but actually in each of the churches that we went to, he saw through a new extension build or a conversion of a gallery or whatever, and that meant that he was definitely, a lot of the time he was thinking about the architecture of a church and how it functions and what it should look like. And so I guess I was hearing those conversations around me when I was growing up.
And what was it that attracted you to art and wanting to pursue a career in the arts?
I think I was sort of torn slightly between art and literature. At one point I was thinking of studying art history, but a friend that I knew who was already at St Martin's studying art kind of said, well, if you want to write about art, isn't it a good idea to try making art first and see what it's like, sort of thing. So that's what I did. I sort of persuaded myself that was a good reason to do a BA in fine art.
Now, you're director of Art and Christianity, and I wonder if you could tell me a bit more about what your day-to-day job actually entails. What kind of responsibilities do you have as director?
It's very varied, really, but the main jobs are producing the magazines, so sort of speaking with writers and, you know, being on top of what's being published, what's being exhibited at the moment. We have an editorial board that supports me in that, so that's very helpful. There's the events that are time-consuming to organise, but always worthwhile. I mean, when we do some of the more sort of high-level events, that's usually quite a long, drawn-out process of speaking to people who might give papers or you know, and just coordinating a programme that actually really works, that really gels and gives people, you know, people that are paying money to come along to these things, gives them something that they really enjoy hearing. And then there's all the sort of minutiae of running a small charity, you know, doing the fundraising, the accounts and all of that, which, you know, I get little bits of help from, and I have a brilliant set of trustees who pitch in as well.
Do you have a team, or is it just you and the trustees?
Most of the time it's a team of two. I'm down to one at the moment because my colleague's on maternity leave, but most of the time there are two of us.
What do you enjoy most about your role?
I think it's that it's the talking to people. It's you know, meeting with artists or churches and their, you know, and their congregations, but also the academics that are doing the hard graft of all the research in the background, or speakers that really just kind of light up the subject for you. And that's always amazing. That's really wonderful to be a part of.
So in addition to the journal and study days, you have something called Art in Churches.
Back in 2003, at a similar time that I started working for Art and Christianity, Tom, who was still director at the time, thought it was worthwhile to have somebody in post who could help to bring art into churches. Now, initially, the job was called a Loans of Artworks to Churches Officer, but a curator called Paul Bailey took up that post, and quite quickly it became clear that although I think in Tom's vision it would be sort of borrowing from collections and you know, loans of artworks going, as it said on the tin, kind of going to churches, but Paul's experience led to much more sort of collaborative projects, working with artists to create temporary installations in churches. He worked with Simon Hitchens, he did a whole programme for the City of London Festival, where there were, you know, a number of artists commissioned to make temporary installations in churches. And that really, really took off, I think. And so although the funding has not always been there to have somebody permanently doing that job, we've continued to seek funding to do, you know, intermittently to do projects like that.
And another initiative which you're involved in is called Ecclesiart. Could you tell me about that and how that came about?
It was actually a conversation with a funder who was keen to see that works of art that actually they had funded, but also other works of art in the last 50 years or so, were appreciated and were known about. So we started to select works of art which gave a good representation of works since 1925 that are in a church or a cathedral of any denomination in this country, which are open for anyone to see.
I mean, for those who don't know much about art in churches, are there many contemporary and modern artworks in churches?
There really are, yeah.
There's a surprising number.
Yeah, there's a surprising number. And as I say, ours is only a selection. There's just a possibility that we might be able to try and work on a database that would seek to plot everything that exists, or, you know, everything that we can find. But what exists on Ecclesiart is, as I say, a good selection. And I think if you just literally flick through it on our website, it's kind of incredible, you know, and it's there's treasures all over the place.
Ecclesiart is available to view now at artandchristianity.org/Ecclesiart. The project currently lists more than 80 permanent works of art in churches and cathedrals, reflecting the diversity of commissions and charting developments in ecclesiastical art and design. Laura began our tour of works in London churches with a visit to St Michael and All Angels in London Fields.
So Laura, could you tell us a bit about what we're looking at here?
So in this church, we've got a square building with a domed roof. It's very simple. It has these three bays for the windows, and above each of the window sets are these extraordinary murals by John Hayward, who's really one of the country's most prolific ecclesiastical artists. He was very influenced by Byzantine art and also by modern art. I mean, you can see here we've got paintings that are reminiscent perhaps of Braque, of sort of cubist art. We've got the picture plane is sort of sliced up by lines and very, very delicately done. But you can definitely see the influence of some of the cubist artists there. Also, Sutherland, I think, was quite a big influence on him. So the six murals that are here depict scenes that come from the Bible where angels appeared. The church is dedicated to St. Michael and All Angels. And we've got two narratives from the Old Testament, Adam and Eve. There's also Jacob, who's sleeping and dreaming and seeing many angels going up and down the ladder, as happened in his dream. And then we move to the New Testament, and we've got the angel appearing to Mary. On this side, we've got the nativity scene, and then the Garden of Gethsemane. And finally, we've got the angel that appears at the empty tomb when Jesus is resurrected. There are also two angels at the corners of the building. There were supposed to be four, but two were only ever completed.
And when did Hayward make these murals? When were they commissioned?
So the building itself was finished in 1959, and these were brought into the building in 1962, though I think it was around a year's work before that, so started earlier. Hayward also created some window pieces here that show the apostles in stained glass, and then also above the altar there's a Christus Rex hanging there from the corona, and on the outside of the building there's a sculpture by him of St. Michael as well.
And Hayward envisaged these pieces as a unified whole rather than individual artworks, is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It was, I think, something that grew out of the liturgical movement. Many of the architects of that period would work in the same way, where they would really like to sort of control the entire aesthetic of a church. And so often using one artist was a good way of doing that, and sort of commissioning them to make all the works for the church.
And of course Hayward is celebrated and remembered as a glass artist primarily, but these are not glass windows. Could you explain a bit about the technique that he's used here?
Yeah, so they're painted onto canvas using a technique called marouflage, where the painting is done on canvas and then brought to the church and glued to the wall. It's a technique which, you know, for obvious reasons, had its advantages, I guess, just in terms of being able to execute the work off-site and then bring the works to the building and adhere them to the wall.
Now, the building for its time would have been, you know, very contemporary, very modern, and you mentioned that Hayward was influenced by artists such as Graham Sutherland and Braque, who by that time wouldn't have necessarily been the most cutting-edge artists at the time. So I wonder how these murals would have been received at the time, because clearly they're very modern in terms of church art, but in the wider contemporary art world, would they have been seen a little bit old-fashioned, perhaps?
I think that's likely, yes. I mean, in 1960, there would have been more sort of cutting-edge artists working at Coventry, for example. But I suspect he was, as we said, sort of well-respected, but perhaps not in that kind of, cutting-edge art world.
So Hayward's style, it's like a hybrid mix of cubism-influenced figuration with Byzantine arts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And also the early Renaissance paintings that you see here, very clearly referenced by a black and white checkerboard floor that Mary's kneeling on. Above her head is a very simplified building that, typical of Duccio or somebody like that, where there's just some red clay tiles on the roof and white pilasters either side of her. But the whole scene is then sort of drawn, almost sort of drawn together and pulled apart by this sort of cubist treatment of it, and the lines of the angel's wings, which create a kind of frame. The angel's left wing is cutting across the top right-hand part of the image and the building that Mary sits under. But with these sort of dynamic gestures as well, I mean, the angel's foot, I love. The right foot sort of sticking out from the bottom there, sort of bursting beyond the picture frame as well.
The way that he uses horizontal and vertical lines is very pronounced in the image of Jacob's ladder, or Jacob's dream. I mean, it does look almost like a cubist painting, doesn't it?
It does. And I think what we have there is Hayward trying to depict a ladder without putting a ladder in it, literally. I mean,
using the form of the angels as a ladder with their strong lines.
Yeah, I mean, the lines look like they're sort of really parts of the robes, but actually do create this sort of ladder effect of them as they go upwards into heaven and come down.
And did his style develop much over the years, or did he keep with this slightly cubist inflected figuration?
I would say he kept with it, really. You do see it right to the end. His last work was for a small church in Limpsfield in Surrey, a stained glass window of St Cecilia. And it's got all of this sort of angular abstraction in it, but it's essentially a figure with a very Byzantine feel to the facial features, and I mean perhaps his colour moved forward quite a bit. These colours here, I would say, are very sort of Festival of Britain. They're very muted, the sort of blues and golds, and I think particularly in glass, he probably got a little bolder in his use of colour.
For the next stop on our tour, Laura took me to Lumen United Reformed Church near King's Cross to visit a contemporary sculpture installed in a large street-facing window.
Okay, so we're here in Bloomsbury and we're standing in the rain, and we've come to Lumen United Reformed Church. And what have we come to see, Laura?
We're looking at a piece by Rona Smith, which is called Northern Elevation. It's a piece that sits inside the church building, but within a very large north window. The church was reordered and redesigned, really, by Theiss and Kahn architects back in the early 2000s. And as part of that, they commissioned some new artwork for the building. This artwork's really meant to appeal to everyone. It signifies that part of the building is, in fact, a cafe space that's community space open to, you know, everybody, all faiths and none. This is a very diverse area, and the church was very keen that alongside the cross, which is also on this outside northern wall, there was something that might be recognisable to people of other faiths.
And we're looking at a very sort of geometric design, aren't we? So if you describe what the piece actually looks like.
Well, it's made of bronze, and the side pieces are fixed to the wall. It's almost like a framework, perhaps, that you might find on the outside of a building. But instead, it's on the inside. It's made up of squares in a geometrical pattern that comes from a central void. So these small squares get larger as they grow outwards, almost like a flower or a star. And the pattern repeats and gets larger. And then towards the top of the window frame, those squares become really large. And that's when the framework itself starts to curve into the building.
And this kind of geometric pattern, we see that across different religions, don't we?
Certainly. It's very apparent in mosque design and geometric design in the Islamic faith. I think it also appears in Hindu decoration and in Buddhist ones as well. It's definitely got that feel to it, that it is representing something eternal, perhaps, or spiritual, but it's also very recognisable and sort of easy to access and engage with, I think.
And it's very visible from the street. I mean, it takes up the whole window. I think you mentioned to me that it's is it illuminated at night?
It's not exactly, but when the lights are on inside, there's this lovely glow from inside, and the framework is silhouetted by that light, so you see it really well in the evening when the lights are on inside the building.
And this is unusual, I think, for Ecclesiarch, because this building is not currently used as a place of worship, is it?
No, I think they're going through some changes at the moment, but it's used a lot by artists and by arts groups, and they do have a missional presence here. They're doing community work here, but I think they're not holding worship here at the moment. I mean, you know, all these churches are finding that contemporary life does throw you some challenges, and I think they're just working out what the best way to use their building is at the moment.
Can you tell me a bit about how the commission came about?
The agency Modus Operandi actually commissioned this in partnership with the church. They had seen some of Rona's work through our award scheme that we run. Rona had done a piece in a derelict church in Leeds as a student, which involved exactly the same geometric pattern, but represented on the floor in marble dust. And this was a sort of temporary installation, very beautiful again, the marble dust sort of moving as people walked around the building. And they approached her to ask if she would make this work for this large window space. And actually, I think it was probably a bit of a game changer for Rona, who's gone on to make very large pieces in metal for the outsides of buildings. I mean, you can see on her website really great examples of that.
And was this the first time that Rona had made work for an ecclesiastical building?
Yes, and shame to say, I think it is the last time she was, but to any churches listening, I think she'd be a great person to commission again for something.
So tell me why you've selected this piece to show us today.
I think it's a really good example of a way in which an artwork can be both elegant and contemporary and yet really speak to millennia of people who have faith. And whatever you recognise in it, I think it speaks to something quite deep. And as I say, that might be a traditional religious geometric form that represents something quite specific, but it might just be, you know, the notion that geometry has this sort of resonance with our deepest selves. Another reason I think also is that I just think it's very clever. I think it's really wonderful the way it positions itself both from the outside of the building, but it also within the building.
For the final stop on our tour, Laura took me to Chelsea to visit St Luke's Church, a 19th century neo-Gothic Anglican building. Okay, Laura, so you've brought us into St Luke's Church in Chelsea, and we've come right up to the front, to the altar, and just above the altar on either side are two stone sculptures, carvings of Adam and Eve. Could you tell us a bit about who made them and why you've brought us here?
These are sculptures by Stephen Cox, who's now a very established and well-respected British sculptor. He works predominantly in ancient stones that are quarried from really important and ancient quarries throughout the world. He's practiced in India and Egypt, in some of the most extraordinary places, learning both from local craftsmen but also from local cultures and religious traditions. And these works were commissioned in 1997 for two empty niches, which are, you know, rather surprisingly, were completely without any sculptures, but flank, as you said, the altar.
Do we know why they were left empty?
Sometimes sculptures are removed for whatever reason, perhaps becoming unfashionable or get damaged. I mean, you know, if we're talking during the Reformation, then often sculptures in niches were damaged irreplaceably. I mean, it does follow a tradition in some sense of replacing sculptures of figures in niches like this, and you know, mostly they would be saints that we'd see, or apostles, but here we have Adam and Eve. Well, if we start with Adam, perhaps.
Adam's on the right-hand side.
Adam's on the right, and in a distinctively sort of reddish-brown marble, which is in fact imperial porphyry, the world's hardest stone from the quarries in Egypt and the Eastern Mountains. I think as Stephen, you know, has made this almost his sort of lifetime work, this has allowed him access to some of these incredible quarries and marbles. So almost certainly this is a single piece of stone carved in what I think you would say is almost a semi-abstract treatment of a figure. We can just about make out, you know, the defining features of a man. That band across almost the top of the sculpture is folded arms, and then, yes, perhaps a head that's buried within the arms. But very beautifully carved, very smooth marble. But at his feet, he's standing on more roughly hewn and possibly uncarved, actually, extension of the marble, which is looks to me like a rock or a boulder, and quite possibly represents the sort of hard ground that Adam is reduced to working with once he's expelled from the Garden of Eden. And opposite, in the other niche, exactly symmetrical to it, at the other side of the reredos here, is Eve, who's in a much darker, almost greenish marble. It's Hammamat breccia, taken from the oldest stone quarry in the world. And Eve, again, recognisable, you know, she has breasts, but similarly her arms are raised and folded across her chest. And at her feet, there's, again, roughly hewn, but this time most definitely carved, is the serpent, kind of coiled around, creating a sort of plinth for her almost, but with its head reaching upwards towards her. And they fill those spaces very quietly, I think. I mean, they're almost quite hard to spot when you first come into the church. There's a Reredos painting in the centre which captures your attention quickly, and a very colourful stained glass window above it.
I think it's really interesting that he's used this stone. We can't get too close to the sculptures to see the patina on the surface, but they look very understated. But I should imagine close up there's quite a lot of texture in the patterning of the stone.
Yeah, there certainly is, and there are some works of Stephen's that you can, indeed you can touch. I mean, the two I'm thinking of particularly are at Canterbury Cathedral, where he carved an altar for St Anselm's Chapel in the cathedral, and obviously that's used day by day for the Eucharist.
And the style is a very modern, slick style of sculpture, not really in keeping with anything else in this church, but it doesn't look out of place, does it?
No, I mean, I think they hold their own within a busy and, you know, typically kind of fairly Gothic Victorian interior. But I mean, maybe they do that just by being different and very understated, as you say. I think there's something about the posture of the figures that really does capture you and hold you once you've seen them.
I mean, I really enjoy that mixture of styles we've got going on here with the neo-Gothic niche and then the more contemporary sculptural presence, which reminds me of the Hayward pieces we were looking at this morning, where there's that mixture of styles going on.
Yeah, it is a really interesting way to work. And I mean, I would hope increasingly there are more chances for that kind of way of working. I've seen over the last 20 years, you know, a handful of quite significant commissions for sculptures within empty niches. St Albans, for example, at the Abbey there, they commissioned Rory Young to make new figures for their empty niches, but they're done in a very figurative, realistic style. I mean, they really work, and they do have a contemporary feel to them, but they're not anything like this in terms of the restraint that Stephen has in his work.
Although Laura's focus today has been on London churches, the geographical spread of ecclesiarch is wide, covering the whole of Britain, from cities and towns to rural parishes. I asked Laura if there were any national highlights that she wanted to tell us about.
You couldn't do better than just to go to Liverpool Cathedral, both of them, in a day. And, you know, there you would probably see, well, you'd see probably over 20 different artists. At Liverpool Anglican Cathedral, there are works by Elizabeth Frink, by Adrian Wisniewski, by Christopher Lebrun, Craigie Aitchison, Tracy Emin in the churchyard, and above the west door, actually. Tracy Emin's neon piece won the award scheme that we run back in 2011, I think it was. And then if you walk along Hope Street to the Catholic Cathedral, there are works by Robert Brumby, by Kerry Richards, Don Potter. I mean, some of these names are, you know, are kind of obscure in a sense, but they're, you know, they're artists that really shouldn't be forgotten about. And, you know, these places are, I think, holding works which are not just representative of their work, but often very good pieces of their work.
And these works which have been cited in churches, places of worship, they're not using the buildings as an exhibiting space. They are part of the life of the church and the community who worship there. What kind of value do artworks bring to communities of faith?
It's really about involving you as a participant in the life of God. And so, you know, creativity and visual things and material things are all part of that. And so if you can bring, you know, if you can bring somebody to a closer understanding of what it means to worship in a Christian place or just to be in a church or a cathedral by a picture or by a sculpture or by stained glass, then I think that's its job done, in a sense. I mean, it won't always work for everyone, and I know, and actually Liverpool, some of those paintings I mentioned are very sort of Marmite-y for people. Some people love them and some people hate them.
What would be the process for a church who were interested in maybe commissioning a work of contemporary art for the building?
I mean, we have a set of guidelines actually that we've produced with the Church of England in partnership. You know, you begin in the same way you would do with any public piece of art. So you create a brief. You ask what it is you want. You ask the stakeholders around you. You talk to your congregation, find out what they want. It's generally thought best to kind of then narrow things down and perhaps work with a small committee and you know, work through those ideas and the best way that you might identify an artist to bring those ideas into life. And actually that's, I think, the point at which most churches think, help, we need some help here. I'm asked all the time, you know, can you suggest some artists that we might look at? And That again, actually, that's one of the reasons why we started Ecclesia Art, was it's just a really good tool for people to say, oh yeah, I like that, or I don't like that, and I can see that that might work in our church.
And beyond making suggestions, does art and Christianity get involved in the process much?
It tends not to, partly because we don't really have time and resources for that. But we do, you know, we're able to offer as much advice as anybody wants, really. So if somebody does just want to have a list of artists to look at, that's fine, we can do that. But we can also stay more involved as well through the process if they need it.
Other than supporting churches, does Art and Christianity help to support artists in the creation of works for churches?
Yeah, I suppose we do. I mean, it's a two-handed thing that, you know, we can help a church, but at the same time, artists very often don't really know how to navigate working with a church, and you're almost sort of interpreting between the two sometimes. So yeah, artists quite often come to us and ask for a bit of help with that as well.
Laura Moffat, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
And that's it for this episode. Many thanks to Laura Moffat. To find out more about art and Christianity and how to support its work, head over to artandchristianity.org. Exhibiting Faith is supported using public funding by Arts Council England. Subscribe to Exhibiting Faith wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to leave a review. Until next time.